You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting figures in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we talk to a true Brooklyn original, Sky Zoo. Since his 2006 debut mixtape, Sky Zoo has brought a deep attention to lyricism and his special brand of Brooklyn swagger to the rap game. Taking the lessons of classic 90s rap, including those of his one-time neighbor, Biggie Smalls, and adding modern feels and subject matter, Sky has released a string of well-received albums and mixtapes, including our personal favorite, the superb Theo vs. JJ, Dreams vs. Reality, from earlier this year. Sky Zoo's newest album, A Dream Deferred, is released today. We began our conversation with him by asking him about four of his favorite 1990s New York City rap albums, once he shouts out on his 2009 song, Return of the Real. I know that you are a big fan of that kind of early, mid-90s rap. You know, New York hip-hop.
Yeah,
you know,
to a point, yeah. I'm definitely a fan of it all. Fan of that and a fan of, you know, everything before and after that as well.
Right, obviously, name drop Rick Cannon and stuff. And,
right,
and some
right,
of your records and stuff.
Yeah.
But there are four, on that Return of the Real song, mm-hmm. you name drop four records. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of want to go through them, and I was hoping you could give me just a little bit about each of them, how they touched you, your impressions of
absolutely.
Them, why you mentioned them.
Absolutely.
Whatever. So start with Ready to Die.
Ready to Die. Growing up the block from Biggie, you know, a lot of people know me, know my story or my Wikipedia, whatever it is, and they know I grew up a block away, you know, yeah. St. James, he was between Gates and Fulton, I was between Gates and Green, so literally, you know, a block away, and seeing all that, you know, seeing Big coming up as a kid, seeing Big as the older dude, you know, and seeing him start to pop, and then really pop, and then, you know, move, and then still come back to the hood, and all, you know. Seeing all that just meant the world to us. Us as in me and my friends who we ran around every day. Every day we walked by his building playing ball and not knowing the significance of it because we was 11 years old. You know what I mean? Yeah. So every day just seeing that and what it meant to us and what it still means to us, you know. So when you hear Ready to Die, those things happen in that neighborhood, you know. So off top, that's, you know, it. The value of importance is through the roof on that album. Just from neighborhood alone, you know what I mean? Outside of the lyricism, outside of the storytelling, outside of how great and terrific that project is, you know, just neighborhood value alone, because that was right there around us, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And Cuban Links?
Only built for Cuban Links. Eighth grade, 13. Man, me, and there was this Puerto Rican kid, Anthony, in my class. And that was all we talked about and listened to, man. And he used to dress like that. Like, he would come to school with, like, you know, army fatigue pants, army fatigue jacket with the hoodie and the Russ Timbs at 13, looking like we were going to rob a bank. But, you know, he would dress like that era and that aura and all that. And we was in class every day just talking about that album. You know what I mean? Just talking about, you know, what they were saying and not even knowing the significance of half of what they were saying because we was 13.
Right.
So we knew what was going on. We knew what was being talked about and what they was doing and the activities, but we couldn't have known every single thing.
Every single
13.
Obscure kung fu movie
yeah,
or whatever.
And, or yeah. even deeper than that, every, you know, narcotic reference and every slang. You know what I mean? Mm. We was only 13. You
right.
know, we knew what we saw, but we wasn't in it. But, you know, it caught us, man. And it was special. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? It was really special. And that album, you know, I always say out of all the Wu-Tang solo albums, Ray had the best beats on as far as the albums. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Iron Man would definitely be neck and neck with it as far as that first run of solo. If you look at, you know, Liquid Swords, Iron Man, T'Challa, you know, Old Dirty Joint, Ray Joint. If you look at that first run of the Wu solo albums,
yeah.
Ray definitely had the best beats. But Iron Man was right next to it, right up under it, if anything. But that Purple Tape had the best beats. You know what I mean?
And a huge one for you and one you quote throughout your catalog is Illmatic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Illmatic, I think it's self-explanatory. You know, just what it means, man. Just what he was saying. You know, that New York state of mind and that memory lane and that it ain't hard to tell. And it's just, I mean, One Love showed me how to write stories in raps. You know, when I was rhyming as a kid, I was in lunchroom table, just rhyming, you know what I'm saying? I was just banging on the table rhyming. But, you know, hearing that showed me how to write stories, you know, when you know, Dear Born, You'll Be Home Soon. You know, it was just, you know, out in New York, same shit is going on. I was just like, damn, like, you know, and I was so young, you know, I was 94. What was I, 12 or going on 12? But it really showed me how to write stories and rap, you know what I mean? And that stuck with me forever.
And I'd save the best for last. Both this album and this artist are iconic to you, and you
absolutely
quote him a ton.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm going to say.
Absolutely.
Obviously, Reasonable Doubt.
Yep. Absolutely. Not sure if there's ever been a more poetic or perfect debut, hip-hop-wise, outside of my own, of course. but not sure if there's ever been a more poetic and seamlessly woven together project, man. As far as a debut, a debut hip-hop album. Not sure, you know, because that, I mean, just what was going on, it was just like, it was meant to be, like, from the samples that were chosen to the way the drums were laid on top. Even, like, the parts of the samples that were chosen. Like, you could sample a record, and I could sample a record, the same record, and we can chop it differently. Just the way those records was chopped on that album, you know? And then the things he was talking about and, you know, the way, like he always said, you know, the drug game had been talked about so many times, but never from that side of the table, you know? I think the closest to that was the Purple Tape. I think that was the closest where he talked about, you know, Ray talked about the ills and things that was going on, but not as heinous and not as, you know, yo, listen, this is what it is. Like, I wake up and my heart is beating every day through my chest. Like, it wasn't to that extent, and Jay took it there to that extent. You know, the things he talked about on that album, I mean, it was just, Regrets is my favorite, probably my favorite Jay-Z song ever, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just, I sold it off, cracked the OPM in third person. I don't want to see them. So I'm rehearsing with my peoples out of GM from a remote location in the BM. Like, it's just like, what is going on, man? Like, and you saw it, you know what I mean? It's special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, before, when we were, you know, introduced you to Rap Genius, and we were showing, you know, going through the notes and stuff, we talked a lot about the Theo versus JJ mixtape, which is my favorite work of yours.
Thank you.
Can you talk a little about the concept behind that? Like, what kind of influence did the Cosby Show and did the Cliff character in particular have on you and on your aspirations as a kid?
As far as Cliff, as far as
Bill
Cosby?
Yeah.
Well, just growing up, you know, we saw that on TV. That was on in the crib every day, you know. And I had young parents. You know, my parents had me when they was 20 and 19. You know, my pops was 20, my mother was 19. So I got young parents. And but that was on every day in the crib, you know, every Thursday rather in the crib. And I remember telling my pops before I started rapping, I remember being like 5 years old and saying, yeah, I want to be a doctor like Bill Cosby. Because it was on TV and he was black and he was cool and he had money and he cracked jokes and, you know, he had a pretty wife and he was just kind of swagged out before the term existed, you know. So, but that, I mean, that was a short-lived dream as far as becoming a doctor. But, you know, I remember saying that just because of the show. And that did that to a lot of people. I mean, I've read stories on people that have said, yeah, I became a doctor because of that show. I became a lawyer because of that show. I became a counselor because of that show. Or even with the spinoffs, you know, I went to a black college because of A Different World. You know what I mean? Like, those things happened, you know what I mean? And to me, it just showed another side, like, you know, where we was living at wasn't like that. It wasn't like, you know, the Cosby Show at the time in the 80s, you know, but right. they showed another side of black life. And my pops, even though we didn't live like that, my pops made sure I understood that that existed. Mm-hmm. You know, I was the kid in the neighborhood who had both his parents in the house. I was the kid who we lived in the same neighborhood as whatever going down outside. But when you came in the crib, everything was immaculate. We had black art on the walls. My pops had jazz playing. But when you stepped out them doors, it was the events that made Ready to Die mm-hmm. on that album. You know what I mean? So it was such an you know, a contrast and the irony of it all. And it shaped me to who I am, man, you know? Yeah. Definitely.
Excellent. Speaking of your father, in Barrow Brothers, you mm-hmm. talk about him, right?
Yeah.
You say, paper made veins. My father already wrote this.
Yeah. Oh, well, it wasn't... it was just a slick line. You know, it wasn't really too deep. My pops isn't musical at all. You know,
right.
he loves music, but he never rhymed. He never, you know, sang a note. He never
But he used to make you watch Spike Lee movies. He talked to the voice about that.
Exactly. Yeah.
How else did he influence you?
Just being there for me. You know, I literally, my pops was everybody's pops on my block, you know, because he was the only pops.
Right.
So everybody came to my pops for advice. Mr. Taylor, how do I do this? Mr. Taylor, how do I fix that? Mr. Taylor, everybody. I got best friends where I would be doing whatever. If I was out with a girl or whatever, I come home and my best friend, my man Adrian, would be at my house. I'm like, son, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I had to talk to your pops about whatever, whatever. I'm like, all right, I'll be upstairs. Come to holler. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to the store. Meet me over there. You know, like, that was my pop. So just being there more so than anything. But, mm-hmm. you know, in a more direct, literal sense, you know, making me watch Spike Lee movies and making me understand what black art was and the significance of it and, you know, teaching me the value of a dollar and teaching me the value of being a man of your word and sticking around and going for whatever you believe in, standing tall for it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Those things impacted and affected the music, and they show in the stories that I tell.
Right. And one place they show really directly is, mm-hmm. you know, Spike Lee is my hero, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about Spike Lee movies mm-hmm. and stuff. So a sort of two-part question about Spike. First, when you were growing up, mm-hmm. what was it about his work that was inspirational to you? About his work, his persona, the fact that he had his office and, you know, not that far from where you were, whatever. Like, what was inspirational about that? And has what you admire in his movies, has that changed over the years for you?
Well, just the first part. Growing up, you know, he put Brooklyn on screen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He put it on... You know, he put it up
there. And not just Brooklyn, but your neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Right. And, you know, so when we saw Do the Right Thing and Crooklyn and all those things, it was just, wow, you know, you saw all these black faces, you know, on this big screen telling these stories, man, you know. And my pops was big on black, black, black. You know, that was my pops. He, you know, gave me books, you know, Black Panther books, taught me about Huey P. Newton. That was my pops. So it was tying into all that, you know, it was black faces on these screens telling these black stories about black lives and telling them the way that they really were. They weren't toned down and they weren't hyped up. It was just an exact showing of this is what it is. Mm-hmm. And I caught that, and it affected my music because that's what I do. I don't downplay anything, and I don't brag or boast on the ills or, you know, yeah, we out here getting money and fuck. Nah, I don't do that either.
Mm-hmm.
I just show you what it is, and you take from it what you take from it, and whatever side of the fence you want to play, that's your decision. But I just show you what it is, and that directly comes from Spike.
Nice.
To me, that's what directly comes from him. As far as where he's at with it now, my views or, you know, fandom has never changed. I don't think it ever will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just that much of a fan of his work and what he does. And I think a big part of me being a diehard Knicks fan has to do with him, you know, besides the fact that it's in my household, it's my pops and all that. But I think a part of that subliminally is Spike, too. Spike liked the Knicks. I liked the Knicks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that started at an early age, too. You know, just that whole representation of the city, you know, he really embodies that. And I always felt that.
Yeah, definitely. And it's appropriate you have Quelle on the song. We had Quelle here. He said, I basically worship Spike Lee also. So
yeah, you know, that's how the song came about. We was in the studio. We was working on his mixtape. He got a mixtape called Attack the Block.
Yeah, it's a great tape.
Yeah, and he called me, like, yo, what you doing tonight? Can you come to the studio? So I went down to the studio. We did the record, wrote the verse, knocked it out. And he was like, what's up, man? You know, I know you got some new stuff. Let me hear something. So I pull out the flash drive. I plug it up, start playing joints. He was like, yo, the album sounding crazy, da-da-da-da-da, when you dropping it. So we chopping it up. And I was getting to the next song, and I said, yo, this next joint I'm about to play is called Spike Lee Was My Hero. And he said, yo, I haven't even heard it yet, and I love it. Because, he said, I haven't even heard it yet, and I love it because Spike Lee was my hero, too. And I was like, oh, word up. So I played the joint, and when it went off, he started walking around the room doing the puff dance. Like, he was like, oh, my gosh. He was like, yo, I don't want to tell you how to do your album, but if you need me on a song, please put me on this song.
Yeah.
And I was like, done deal. You know what I mean? Right. Like, what? Like, yeah. Done deal. And we got records from the past and all that, but I was like, man, done deal. And then the verse was done in a couple days, and that was it. You know what I mean? And he blacked out on it, and, you know, we had a good time.
Nice. In that last answer, and what was important about Spike's movies, right? You're mm-hmm. talking about, like, it was accurate, mm-hmm. right? He put sort of accurate picture of life on the screen, and that you try to do that in
with
your
music,
work,
yeah.
right? And that's something that I kind of wanted to talk to you about, because from the beginning of your career, right, mm-hmm. from the corner store thing, mm-hmm. you've been into being honest and real in a degree that's unusual, even for rap, which, you know, a lot of artists pride themselves on those things, at least in theory, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, in theory.
right? So why is being honest and accurate in that way, why is that so important? I mean, you're not a reporter, right? You're
right.
an artist.
Right.
So
it's just how I grew up. You know what I mean? You don't mean things that you don't say things you don't mean, and you don't mean things that you don't say. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just how I came up. It goes back to my pops of standing tall and being a man for whatever you believe in and whatever you are and what you are and what you represent. You know, that's just a part of who I am as a person that plays out in music, you know. I always saw the bigger picture. I always saw what was going on and what could be going on and why there's a difference. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to talk about that. You know, I'm not a conscious rapper by any means. I never talk about politics ever. I never talk about saving the world. I mean, there's a Jay-Z line, one of my favorite lines, where he says, there's much bigger issues in the world I know, but first let me tell you about the world I know. You know what I mean? So I always felt like that was what I did. Even before he said the line, it was like, yeah, word up. You know what I mean? Because that was always the stance I took. I never talk about politics. I never talk about healing the world. I never talk about, you know, religion. I just talk about what goes on outside of my door. You know, what goes out in my neighborhood and what goes on with the people that I call my friends and who call me friends, you know, right. who call me a friend. You know, I that's it. That's what I talk about. And yeah. whatever you take from it, you take from it. But that's what I know, you know.
Awesome. A kind of related thing on going back to the Theo versus JJ for a second. You had a really great line on Be Well that, to me, kind of summed up the central idea of that record and ties into what you just said about, like, there are the way things are and the way that things could be, and maybe there's a distance between them.
Mm-hmm.
You say, trying to be a Huxtable, but predestined to be an Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping you could expand on that.
Yeah, you know, just the line just came out of the clear blue. Sometimes you just reach up and grab a line, and you know what I mean? Yeah. And it was one of those. And it made the most sense, you know, because it's, you know, the tape is split in two parts. It's the Theo side and the JJ side. So I'm rapping as if I was, you know, each character, respectively. And, you know, trying to be a Huxtable, but predestined to be an Evans. See what luck will do. You know what I mean? Like, see what luck will have. If luck has anything to do with it, see how it plays out. Like, feels like, you know, who I am or where I'm from or what I look like or whatever. It's kind of has me predestined to be an Evans, even though I'm trying to be the unthinkable and the rare, which is a Huxtable, mm-hmm. in some people's eyes, you know what I mean? Because, you know, it ain't that rare. You go to certain places and there's a lot of prestigious, wealthy, well-off black families that are cultured and, you know, all of that. But trying to be a Huxtable but predestined to be an Evans, see what luck would do, you know?
Yeah.
If we was ever to see an exit, keep it wonderful, you know, just, you know how it goes.
Yeah. And one final thing about the Cosby mm-hmm. record is, like, kind of the spirit or the idea of Ennis Cosby
yeah.
comes up a few times mm-hmm. on that record.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you first heard about what happened to him? Do you remember?
Well, I was young. I think I was 14 when he passed. So it didn't really hit me like that because, you know, for one, you didn't know a lot about him. You know, you
right.
knew who Bill Cosby was, but you didn't know a lot about his family which is a good thing, kept it private and all that. You didn't know a lot about his kids and all that and who they were and everything until that happened. That was the first time you had really heard anything about them. Yeah. So as a kid, you know, I definitely understood the relevance of it, but I didn't, it may not have hit home as layered as it did later on. But I mean, because to a lot of people, it's just something that happens. It's a sad, unfortunate situation that happens every day. But the way it played out into the tape was, you know, he came from a family well off, and he, you know, he had a character based after him. Theo is directly based after Ennis. If you know anything about The Cosby Show, every child is based after one of his real kids because his kids were born in that order. He had a girl, a boy, a girl, and a girl. And they were all based after those characters. Every one of them. Each kid in his real life had a kid directly based off of them on the show. So you kind of knew him without knowing him because you knew Theo.
Yeah.
You know, Ennis was dyslexic. Ennis wound up being a counselor. He wanted to be a counselor and he went to Columbia. The whole, it's just like the show. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, he just took his life and put it on TV. But, you know, it just shows that he came from this well-off family and, you know, the ills still got him in a way that, you know, he didn't deserve. You know what I mean? The ills still got him. And it shows you now what? Like, how, there's no way to protect yourself from it but so much. Like, now what? You know?
Yeah.
But, and I said, you know, if he was still alive, my biggest fan would be Ennis. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, rat be sort of my way of becoming Clifford. Like, I'm not going to be a doctor, but I want that same lifestyle that Cliff had. So rap is my way of becoming Clifford. And if he was still alive, my biggest fan would be Ennis. I think so, because I think he would get it. I think he would get what I do. And it was just a slick line, too. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, I think he would get it of all people because he understands what it was and what it could be and what it should be. So
awesome. Something that was a pretty heavy topic, so I wanted to get something a little lighter. On Pockets Full, you make that brief reference to Candy Rain. What are some of your other favorite kind of 90s R&B songs?
Oh, man. everything Mary J. Blige was doing, from What's the 411 to My Life, you know, all that stuff. All that old Jodeci Uptown stuff. Total. Total was probably the dopest female group, female R&B group of the 90s. Not saying, you know, they had these Mariah Carey vocals or anything, but the dopest all-around group. Like, there was no group cooler.
Yeah.
Swagged out. No group cooler than them, man. I remember being a kid, like I said, we grew up the block from Big. So that kind of was like a Bad Boy neighborhood almost. You know, you'd see all the Bad Boy posters and the whole deal. And one of my friends as a kid, my younger man or whatever, he his mom's was managing or road managing or something for Total.
Yeah.
And he lived up the block the other way, like past Green on St. James. And one day he was on the block playing, and he was like, and mind you, we're 12, 13 maybe, and we're on the block playing, and he's like, yo, Total's at my house. I'm like, word? He said, Total's at my house right now, because you know my mother manages them. Pew, took off, ran to his crib. So we standing outside, and we didn't have no paper to write on and nothing for autographs, but it was garbage day, so there was like shoeboxes and cardboard outside. So we all started grabbing cardboard and shoeboxes. And we was like, yo, go in the house and get a pen. Go in your house and get a pen. So he went in the house and got a pen, came outside, and they all came out. And we all had these shoebox tops and cardboard pieces ripped off, handing it to them, like to get an autograph. And they signed a little shoebox top and all that, you know. I don't have my shoebox top no more, but they was they were swagged out, man. I mean, epitome of swag before the word existed, man.
Yeah.
There was nobody cooler. If you watched them videos with the, they had the puff bounce and they was like, it was like if you was a guy, they was bagging you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, as if you was a guy, they was probably gonna step up to you in the club and be like, yo, give me your number. You know what I mean? Like, they was swagged out. Like, there was nobody cooler than them three chicks, man. And that first album, that Do You Know, and oh my gosh, man, Puff hit a home run with them boys. So I wish there was another Total, man. I do.
You gotta bring them back at you do a collab.
Yeah, we need three more swagged out chicks that are just cool, but you can't create cool because them chicks was born cool. Like, you gotta be cool. Like, we need a new Total, for real.
Yeah. Awesome. So you were talking about Bed-Stuy a minute ago. I wanted to move to another Brooklyn neighborhood to, you know, be selfish for a second in my neighborhood.
Wow, here?
No, not here. Oh. An Ever Loyal. You mentioned one of my local bodegas, Farmer in the Deli.
Hi. Oh, you in the Fort.
I'm two blocks from there.
You in Fort Greene.
Oh, there's a Farmer in the Deli on Flatbush and Beverly. That's not the one you were talking about?
Oh, nah. I was talking about Myrtle and Adelphi.
Oh.
Myrtle and Adelphi, that's in Fort Greene, right by the projects over there. Myrtle and Adelphi is the Farmer in the Deli that we grew up on. And you can catch me there at least twice a week. Best heroes in the world. Yeah. But I'm sure the question still applies.
Yeah, I was just going to say, did you spend a lot of time in Flatbush? But I guess you spent a lot of time over in
It's right by the hood. Farm in the Deli is like a 15-minute walk from my house, mm-hmm. From where we are and where we was and everything. But yeah, Farm in the Deli, if you've never been to Myrtle and Adelphi, Farm in the Deli might be owned by the same people mm-hmm. as the one by you.
Yeah.
The best heroes in the world. I don't know what it is. It's definitely an ingredients thing, but every time we've been going there since we was, we wasn't even tall enough to look over the counter when we started going to Farming in Deli. So we've been going there almost our whole lives. And every time me and my people's going there, we try to figure it out. Like, what is it? But it's the same ingredients.
Same stuff every other place.
It's boar's head. It's, the same bread. So we're like, what is it? And I think we figured it out. I think it's the mayonnaise.
Revealed.
I think so, because I always forget the name of it, but if you go to Farm in the Deli on Myrtle and Adelphi, they got all the mayonnaise in the back, right behind where they're making the sandwich, and it's these big, humongous, Costco-sized barrels, mm-hmm. plastic barrels of mayonnaise, but they got the name right on it. I just forget the name. They got the brand right on it, and it's not a brand that you would know in the supermarket. I think it's the mayonnaise, because everything else is the same. If you go to the store down the block, it's boar's head, meat, and cheese.
Right, right.
If you go web, it's the same soft bread. It's the same lettuce. It got to be the mayonnaise.
Wow.
Got to be.
Nice.
For real.
Nice. So you have Brooklyn. Obviously, Brooklyn is changing a lot. You can see it here, right?
Yeah.
And you've talked about that on your records. You say, you talk about how the gentrification is still a work in progress. You have that line, my corner's gentrified, but it's still got vans, mm-hmm. right? And all that. So in light of the stadium opening up, in light of the fact that we're right now in kind of ground zero of Brooklyn gentrification in Williamsburg, I was wondering your thoughts on kind of the current state of Brooklyn and how it's changing.
I dig it. As long as the people who had to deal with it when no one wanted to come here mm-hmm. are still able to enjoy it. And that's the problem, because that's not a reality. They're going to kick us out. The way they've already begun to kick us out.
Sure.
The way they kick us out is by raising the rent. The way they kick us out is by changing the stores that we frequent every day in the neighborhood. They close certain mom and pops that have been around for 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Black owned by people who live in the neighborhood or from the neighborhood. They raise the rent, they kick them out, or they buy the building from them at a price that they can't refuse. They kick them out and they turn it into a bike shop, or they turn it into an organic bakery, or whatever it is. And the prices of all those products and things at those stores are not what the people in the neighborhood can afford. Mm-hmm. The people start shopping elsewhere. The people start moving elsewhere. Other people come in with McLaren strollers and minivans and things of that nature. And then there you have it. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And that's not to say it's not about Brooklyn getting better or changing. You definitely want it to be better and change. I mean, there was days where people didn't want to come to Brooklyn. I did a record with Ninth. It never came out, but we did a record. It was a project he was doing a while ago, and it was like a girl. It was like a playful girl record. And he was like, Sky, it's kind of like a playful, your first crush or your first, your first love in junior high or as a kid or whatever. So it was like a playful record. And on the verse, I ended my verse. It was about this girl that I used to date in eighth grade. And I ended the verse by saying, she was from Park Slope. I lived in the sty, and she wouldn't come to my crib because I lived in the sty. And that was how I ended the verse. You know what I mean? Like, she couldn't come to my crib. Mother wouldn't let her come to the sty. We had to hang out on her block. We hung out in Park Slope, or we hung out at school in Manhattan. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just ties back into that. Brooklyn was that place, where people didn't want to come. Mm-hmm. Now it's different, and that's fine. That's good. Who wants to be hell on earth? You know what I mean? Like, that's fine, as long as the people who had to deal with hell on earth get to enjoy heaven. What I mean? And that's not a reality. They're pushing us out every single day. I feel like I'm smack dead in the middle of it. My block where I live at, smack dead in the middle of gentrification. Because if you go one way, it's one type of life. If you go another way, it's another type of life. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to kick us all out.
Are you still in Bed-Stuy?
Yeah, I'm still in the neighborhood, yeah.
So, or the Stuyvesant Heights, as the real estate people are trying to brand it.
Stuyvesant Heights, or they move the line to Clinton Hill. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, Clinton Hill starts here now. Wait a minute, Clinton Hill should start here.
Right.
Oh, no, it starts here now. Right. You know what I mean?
So I remember when that happened here when East Williamsburg all of a sudden encroached into Bushwick.
Right, right, yeah. It was all East Williamsburg or Williamsburg South. Or it's like, oh, word? That's Bushwick. All right.
Definitely. You know what I mean?
We'll be right back with the second half of our conversation with SkyZoo. If you're curious about any of the songs mentioned on this show or about SkyZoo's new album, A Dream Deferred, you can get lyrics, audio, and explanations on rapgenius.com. You can also check out Sky's own Rap Genius verified account, where he explains even more about his own songs, at rapgenius.com/SkyZoo. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. We continued our conversation with SkyZoo by asking him about the story behind his decision to start rapping at only 9 years old.
Going back to the sort of the days of your youth here, like we were talking about, your this single, Jansport Strings, right? Obviously talks about Chi Ali appearing on TV, on the box, right?
The music box.
On the box, yeah.
Yeah.
And you go back again and again on the record to that image of that being like this formative moment. What about that that appearance in particular made you want to start rhyming?
It was because he looked like the guys in my lobby that were a little older than me but were still young. You know, when you watched videos back then as a kid, I was 9 years old. If I'm watching Kid and Play on TV, or if I'm watching LL Cool J, or if I'm watching, you know, any rapper who was out at the time, Big Daddy Kane and KRS-One, it was awesome. I'm loving it. But these guys are adults. Right. So there's only but so much I can relate to with them because I'm 9 years old. You know, I can look up to them, but relating to them is different. But you had the crisscrosses, you had the ABCs, and you had the youngsters, and you had all these guys that, oh man, they're my age. So you connected with them.
Yeah.
But then you felt like these kids could be in your class because you're literally the same age or maybe a year or two removed.
Right.
So you don't look up to them. You look at them like they're you and you relate. But it's like, damn, well, I could be you and you could be me. But Chi Ali was in the middle. He was 14, so he was older. He had like 5 years on me.
Yeah.
But he was still young enough to relate to. His voice hadn't changed yet. Things he was talking about was relatable, but then it was older than he was talking about going to a girl's house, and he was talking about, you know, him and his man met these two girls and they had to go over there and chill with them and they took the train. And it was just things that I knew. I wasn't going to buy no girl house at 9 years old, but it was things I knew as far as like taking the train and being a kid and being young in New York. And in the video specifically, he was like swagged out, and he was a little older than me, but he still seemed, he looked like the kids in my building. He looked like, you know, you looked at the video, they shot it in the village, and I knew those blocks. Like, oh, mommy, that's the store where so-and-so. And it wasn't a lot of videos that you could do that with back then, at least with kids on it, because Crisscross was in Atlanta, and you know what I mean? So with that, it was New York, and it was, he looked like those guys that were sitting in the staircase when the smell would come under the door and I'd be like, Ma, what's that? And she'd be like, don't worry about it. You know what I mean? He looked like one of those guys. He looked like one of those cool guys in the lobby, you know, tagging the wall. To us, those was the cool guys.
Right.
He looked like that, but he was still young. Man, it wrapped me up like a blanket. I was done. I was like, that's what I want to do right there. And the minute the video ended, you know, I started rapping. I mean, the moment it ended, I started rapping. And I never looked back. So that was the significance of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Going from young rappers then to young rappers now, you say in your new record that you feel like you're the greatest, at least among people born in the 80s or better, right? Who else amongst the kind of 30 and under rappers other than yourself are your current favorites, and why?
30 and under.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that would be the 80s and all that.
Yeah.
Freddie Gibbs, awesome.
Yeah, he's, I love him.
Lyricist, storyteller, just the intensity and he can really, really, really rap. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. A lot of people have intensity and aggression in the music, and you can feel it, but they may not be able to rap that great, but they still, you know, you get into it because you can feel it.
Yeah.
He can really rap, you know what I'm saying? When he's like, you know, I used to let my close partner keep his chopper in my school locker. I'm like, yo, me too. Literally. Yo, me too. You know what I mean? So, like, Freddie could really, really, really rap. Shouts to Freddie. I know him personally. He's the homie. Lupe. I think Lupe is awesome. I always tell people Lupe is probably the Kobe to my LeBron. You know what I mean? Like, Lupe is the one artist that I hear, and I'm like, play that again? And I'm like, wait, wait, be quiet. Let me hear this. You know what I mean? Like, and he's another dude who I know personally as well. Lou is one of a few people who I hear, and I'm like, yeah, okay. Word up. All right, let's go. You know what I mean? Like, you know, Lou, I think Kendrick is dope. I'm trying to think of some other names of that range of age, you know what I mean? There's a good amount of people. I think it's coming back. Wale, of course, you know, Wale is the homie and he gets busy. I've been in the lab with him, you know, numerous times and watched him work, watched me work together, and, you know, the vision is there, you know what I mean? And he gets busy and he's about his pen, like, more so than anything at all. He wants people to really know and understand that he is nice. And he is, you know what I mean? He's super dope MC. My man Torre, you know, he fits in that age bracket. Torre is like my brother. Torre is one of those guys, you know, another one of those guys where you hear the aggression and the intensity and the rhymes, but he can also really, really rap. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, like I said, a lot of people, that intensity and all that and that aggression is there and the passion. So you say, man, his music is dope. He ain't super lyrical, but man, he's nice. You know, and it works. Everybody can't, you know, spit, you know, sun, moon, and stars. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be some type of balance.
What's that great Sean Price thing? Oh, lyrical, miracle, spiritual rappers, he calls them.
Right, right, he don't call me spiritual rapper. I think he calls me a lyrical, miracle rapper. He always says, yo, Sky, you one of the nicest I ever heard, whatever.
Yeah.
Shout out to Sean P. He would definitely be in that conversation that we're talking about with the bracket, but he's a little older.
Yeah.
Another MC too, man, you know, whether my fans like it or not, Drake. I think Drake is awesome. I've never heard a whack verse from Drake, ever. Mm-hmm. Like, all the material he's put out as far as albums and mixed, I thought 2011, I thought he had top three albums of the year easily with Take Care. Easily. And I openly said that on Twitter and interviews, easily, as far as albums. Drake gets busy, you know what I mean? Say what you want, whatever. Drake can rap, like, really, really, really rap. You know, guys, if we all got to sit at a table, if I'm sitting here, Freddie Gibbs sitting here, Kendrick and Lupe and Wale and Drake and Torre, it's going to be a nice table. You know what I mean? Like, that's going to be a really nice table. You know, that guy can rap.
Awesome.
Yeah.
In a lot of your work, you keep coming back to these images of people being asleep and awake. Mm-hmm. And it recurs mm-hmm. a bunch. What do those two words mean to you in the context of your music and in the context of, like, rap and pop?
Oh, man, there's a literal sense, a figurative sense. You know, just the people who may not get it, you know. I think if you had to search my name, the one word, if you search my name on Twitter, the one word that would come up the absolute most associated with it is underrated, as far as when people tweet and say things about me, it's underrated. And I agree, you know, I retweet a lot of that stuff when people say it, because I agree. A lot of people are asleep. A lot of people, you know, still sleeping on the God. Like, you know what I mean? Like Sean P would say, stop sleeping on the God.
Yeah,
like,
there's
a lot of people that still sleep, you know what I mean? Not just with me, but just with the movement and the aura and the mood and the change of everything, you know, as far as lyricism is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that still asleep, you know? And then beyond that, that's the literal, but in the figurative sense, just the sense of these dreams that we all have that we want to go for, you know? Whether it's, you know, music, finance, whatever it may be, you know, a dream deferred and all the dreaming stuff isn't about music. It's about, yo, if you want to be a rapper or a singer, this album is for you. It's not. If you want to be anything, period, this album is for you. You want to be a teacher, you want to be a doctor, you want to stand on the corner, you want to, whatever it is you want to do, this album is for you because you want to do something.
Yeah.
This album is for you because this is going to tell you what's going on and what happens when things don't play out the way they're supposed to or the way you feel they deserve to. And how do you cope? Mm-hmm. That's what this album is about. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, the dream, the sleeping and awake, you know, it all ties in with that.
Awesome. And the Langston Hughes interest comes from your dad originally? He's the one who kind of got you into him?
Nah, the Langston stuff was definitely from school.
Okay.
My pops put me onto a lot of stuff, but the Langston stuff was definitely just from school, mm-hmm. just from being in them AP English classes and learning about him at an early age and reading those books. I mean, you know, we had to read and learn about Dream Deferred and all those different poems in school. You know, we had to read books by Richard Wright, and you know, we had to do all that stuff in English class. So that came from that, and it just stuck. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. One other thing about your writing, mm-hmm. on penmanship. It was just a brief line, but it caught my attention. You say, they say I write a little different. And mm-hmm. I was wondering how you meant that. Like, what do people say is unusual about your style? And I bring this up particularly because, like, I talked to Saul Ames a few weeks ago, and he was really stuck on that word penmanship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's like, you know, his writing, his pen, is the vessel that carries him through. Mm-hmm. And so he always writes penmanship as three separate words, penmanship.
Okay.
So the title of the song caught my interest, and then you saying you write different, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, that comes from the whole the idea that, yo, Sky Zoo is a mad scientist, and you got to listen to his stuff 100 times to get it, and you're not going to understand it, so be ready. And, you know, the Frisbee thing, you know what I mean? Like, people saying, yo, I throw Frisbees. And, you know, I do. I created the term of throwing. I did a record called Frisbees, you know, throwing Frisbees, showing you can catch them. But, you know, people feel like I spit, you know, quasars and sun, moon, and stars. And, nah, like, you know, I rap, you know what I mean? I tell stories in my music. I rap, and, you know, and that's what we do. And you know, that's just who I am, and you know, people say it's different. People get it. Some people don't. People get it later. You know, it takes people some time. Sometimes I say stuff and people get it right away. People are like, yo, when you said da 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 da, that was awesome. I'm like, yep, you got it. Mm. And sometimes people get half of it. Sometimes people, you know, don't get it till late. I've had people be like, yo, man, I listen to Salvation every day. I just got when you said X, Y, Z, and that was brilliant.
Right.
That's a good thing, you know, because I feel like the music, it's supposed to last a long time.
I mean, that's probably the experience you had with Reasonable Doubt, right?
Absolutely.
That's the experience I certainly
absolutely
had with it.
Yo, there's people who get stuff from Reasonable Doubt today. That album came out, what? What is this?
96, right?
16 years ago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's kids with driver's license that was born when that album came out. That's pushing cars now. You know what I mean? And you still getting stuff from it. That's a good thing. Yeah. That was probably some of the best $9.99 you could have spent, because it continues to serve you.
Yeah.
And that's what the music is supposed to do, no matter what genre it is. That's how I feel. You're going to put $9.99 up on iTunes, or you're going to put $13.99 up at Best Buy or whatever it is. I want that to be the best $10 or $20 you had to bust down in a long time, because I want it to continue to go on, you know?
Yeah, definitely. One question I had about the new record is the steel. Who's the steel in Steel Apartment?
Oh, man. Yes. Let's do that. My phone's on fire, too. Steel's Apartment, one of my favorite records on A Dream Deferred, if not my favorite. It's probably neck and neck with, like, two others. Steel is the character in Juice, in the movie Juice.
Oh.
Yeah. The chubby one.
Yeah.
I think his name is Jermaine Hopkins in real life, the actor. Steel is that character. And if you know the movie Juice, they hung out at Steel's apartment every day.
Yeah.
Every day they cut school, they went to Steel's crib, he was cooking up whatever, they was in there smoking cigarettes, cutting class, wilding out, fighting, going to the record store, whatever it was, but they went to Steel's house. They didn't go to nobody else's house. Their lives were shaped in that apartment, in that living room, and they didn't even know it. Mm-hmm. By what they missed out on by not going to school, or what they gained by not going to school, and the things that they were involved with. You know, they was beefing with Radamez, they ran to Steel's apartment. Everything was Steel's apartment. That was home base for them. You know what I mean? Yeah. And the record was about those four friends. The movie's about those four friends, rather. And the record is about me and my three friends, you know? And it's weird because we was just like them. So it's kind of like, damn, they made a movie about us and didn't even tell us. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, god damn, word up, you know? I was Q, you know? I was GQ. I was the one who was with them side by side, shoulder to shoulder, running around every day, whether we was playing ball or whether we was walking up and down the block fighting or whether we was going half on a hero at the store or whether we was, you know, trying to holler at the same girl and get a number or whatever it was. I was cute because I had the music. My other three friends, all they knew about music was what was on BET Rap City and, you know, what we bought at the store and we shared tapes. Yo, let me get a dub of that tape. Yo, let me hold it. Nah, son, come on. Last time I let you hold the tape, you fucked it up and my shit is all messed up now. My shit ain't playing right. Nah, come on, man. Let me hold the tape. All right, son, leave my tape back tonight because if you hold it overnight, your sister gonna rip it up. Like, that was just us, you know what I mean? And that was all they knew about the music. But for me, I wanted the music. We would walk by places and we would see signs that said talent show, open mic, rap battle. And I was the one like, yo, I got to get in there. Yo, give me a pen. Yo, let me write the number down. Yo, let me see your phone, whatever it was. And you know, they was like, oh, man, leave that shit alone, man. We got to go do whatever. Or, yo, man, these girls is waiting for us or what. And I was like, nah, but yo, I'm gonna knock this shit out, man. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and that was us. And my man A, who I mentioned before, my man Adrian, that's like my best friend on the planet. He was Raheem. He was the one who was like, nah, you're going to kill that shit. Like, word up. Like, yeah, we got to do this too, but you know we there to support you. Like, you know we here. Like, he's my biggest fan in life. If somebody said they didn't like me, he wants to hook off on them. You know what I mean? He's that guy. Like,
yeah.
What? You don't like Skyzoo? Fuck out of here. Wow. You know what I mean? Like, he's that guy. Like, he's my biggest absolute fan in the world. He's my brother. He's the one who I was talking about would be at my house talking to my pops when I was dead.
Yeah.
You know, he's a member of my family in a way. But so that was us. So Steel's Apartment is about me and my friends and us coming up and, you know, those things and what made me go this way when they went that way. And we all was every day in the same house. We was at my man crib every day doing things we shouldn't have been doing. We should have been in school or we should have did this or we should have came straight home. But we was at my man crib every day in his basement doing whatever, you know, and trying to find ourselves as teenagers, you know. And it was just like them. So Steel's Apartment is a play on Juice.
On the Juice.
Yeah.
Awesome. A couple more quick things. On Rap Like Me, you talk about Stack and his murder.
Mm-hmm.
What was your relationship like with him?
Oh, man, Stack. Rest in peace, Stack. I met Stack, I want to say, 2000. Numbers could be wrong, but I want to say 2000. This is when I lived in Queens. My pops moved to Queens, so I was bouncing back and forth between Queens and Brooklyn. I was always the kid in school who every Friday had a Nike duffel bag with him because I had to go to one parent's house for the weekend, either my mother or my father. My parents were never together. They split when I was a baby, but they've always remained great friends or whatever. So moral of the story, my pops was in Queens, my mother was in Brooklyn, so I'm bouncing back and forth. And while I'm in Queens, I'm meeting rappers, I'm meeting kids, I'm gaining new friends, you know, just living that life as well. And Stack was one of those friends that I met, you know. I used to be a part of a crew called the Grits. It stood for the greatest rappers in the streets. And it was, you know, we was young, 17, 18, 19, yeah. And we was all from either Brooklyn or Queens. And Stack was one of the members, and that's how we met. And, you know, he was awesome. From day one, he was nice, man, like... I mean, there's old Stack freestyles that people don't even, you know, would never have heard of. S-T-A-C-K, y'all faggot-ass rappers can't see me. I got broads and, you know, like, he said, I got gauze and I'm copping like BJs. I got broads and they crying all over me, sounding like freeway. And y'all scared, I could tell. When I put it in the bag, it's going to make your whole fucking block gel. I got shells, y'all should know that. Like, those is all his rhymes, like old rhymes, you know what I mean? Like, where he was dumbing out before, you know, Bird Gang and everything. And then when that happened, it got even crazier. And I remember when he told me that was going down. I remember when he got with Clue, when we was hanging out and he told me he got with Clue. And I remember when he told me he got with, you know, with Jimmy and them. And, you know, everybody was just so happy for him, man. Like, you know, like, yeah, like you winning. And then, you know, we had spoke. I got a record on Cornerstone Classic called Cop and Go. It's me, Mano, and Stimuli. Originally, it was supposed to be me, Mano, and Stack. And I spoke to Stack, and he was like, yeah, yeah, let's do it. He was like, come to the Rock, you know, come to Far Rockaway. We'll go to the studio, we'll knock it out. And then, you know, he got killed. You know, God bless the dead. So, you know, I put my man Stimuli on it to just tie it up at the end. But I remember going to the funeral and, I mean, just, you know, having to, you know, deal with all that. But shout to Stack, man. What I will say is that he definitely left his mark on the game, you know what I mean? Like, I think in one way or another, he left his mark. You know who Stack is. He has a legion of fans, man, a legion of fans that are diehards. I mean, yeah. You can Google search, Twitter search his name any day, and you got kids now playing Stack, whatever, whatever, now playing. You know, I'm like, legion of fans. So shout to Stack one time for sure, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And it's so sad that you know, you talked about the thing with Jim Jones, and this happened not long after that.
Yeah, it was 07.
Yeah.
It was 07 when it went down. I think he got with Jimmy in 06.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, he deserved much more, but I will say that, you know, he did get a little taste of living. I remember when he went on the tour with Jeezy and Jimmy. I remember, you know, this guy was on 106 and Park, and, you know, he wrote verses for people that was on the radio, and, you know, We Fly High and all these things that he was a part of, and, you know, it was real, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he, you know, he deserved so much more, but he got to the life he talked about was the life he lived, and he got to really enjoy it to a small, small extent, you know?
That's incredible. And one final thing I want to talk to you about. On Definitive Prayer, you have that one line. You say, "See, if I told you everything I ever wanted to say, you'd either Nobel Prize me or scurry away."
Mm-hmm.
And what's something that you wanted to express that you thought your audience might not be ready to hear that might make them scurry away?
I think the things that I talk about currently, if I was to go even deeper, you either Nobel Prize me or you scurry away. Like, I can talk about, you know, I can make records like Steel's Apartment and How to Make It Through Hysteria and, you know, all of these things. You know, I can make records like Langston's Pen and The Bodega and you know, all that. I really got deep into it, you'd either Nobel Prize me for being some incredible writer and thinking, you know, thinker and, you know, and literary genius, quote unquote, or you'd scurry away because it wouldn't be what you feel you can handle or needs to be said to the masses at the moment. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not a preacher. I never was. I don't want to be. I don't want that responsibility. You know, I'm not a preacher. I'm not a quote unquote conscious guy. I'm aware. I'm awake. Like most said, I'm not conscious. I'm just awake. You know what I mean? Like, you know, but that's all it meant. It meant, you know, everything I'm currently doing, if I really even got deeper into it, it could either go one of two ways. You know what I mean? That's all.
Well, if that happens, hopefully we can get some explanations on Rap Genius.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you know what? I think I contradicted myself because I go there on A Dream Deferred. You know, if you really listen to the Rager Romello, you listen to Range Rover Rhythm, you listen to How to Make It Through Hysteria, that record, man. My favorite records on the album, I would say, are Steel's Apartment, How to Make It Through Hysteria, and Range Rover Rhythm.
Yeah.
I love every single record on the album. There's no filler. There's no record, oh, we did that because, oh, we did that because we needed a radio record, or we did that because of this or that. It's really telling the story, no matter what song it is. But those three records are probably my absolute faves. It would be Range Rover Rhythm, How to Make It Through Hysteria, and Steel's Apartment.
Awesome. Why is the Range Rover such a big symbol? Is it because Jay, you know,
had
his whole thing in like 97 with it?
Well, the Range Rover is the all-purpose car. There's all-purpose things in life to me. Navy blue Yankee fitted with a gray bottom is an all-purpose hat. You can wear it with any outfit on the planet. Black, red, cement, Jordan 3s, all-purpose sneakers. You can wear them with anything on the planet. Cargos, khakis, jeans, shorts, sweats. All-purpose shoe. Range Rover is an all-purpose car. It's classy, it's street, it's rugged, it's an SUV where you can pack it up and fill it up with stuff. It's sleek and sexy. Range Rover is an all-purpose car, period. In my surroundings and people from environments like me and what you see and come up around, the Range Rover is the I really, really, really made it car. You know, you may have guys on a corner that make enough money for sneakers, but the guys who they answered to was in Range Rovers.
Right.
You know, Range Rovers was the car. It still is. Range Rover is the car. Like, yeah, he got it. He's important. You know, on the block, he's important. Like, so it was Range Rover Rhythm. You know, that if you went to the Chinese store and you saw a Range Rover parked in front of it, the dude in the Chinese store with the keys to that Rover had on some good jewelry, good watch, and was paying for that Chinese food with a knot. And if you looked in the passenger seat of that Rover, there was probably the baddest girl you had seen in the whole, you know, 3-4 block radius, if not more, nice. Sitting there, you know, looking at her nails or putting a lipstick on or whatever it was. And the dude at the Chinese restaurant swagged out, but he definitely had on some Tims, and he definitely had on a blue Yankee joint with a gray bottom, and, you know, he was pulling out a knot to pay for that, you know, $12 Chinese order. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It just, it meant so much. And Jay really, it existed before Jay said it. It's just Jay was the first one to really say it and put it out there. Like, right. When he was like, you know, the 4.0 and the 4.6. And, yeah. You know, every video he had the Rover back in the early days. Yeah. And I think he still owns one now from what I've heard. I could be wrong. It's an all-purpose car, but it's a status joint, man. It's like people say, yo, you know, you got to have a Benz. You know, you got to have a sports car as a Benz. And then you got to have an Escalade as a truck. But what if you put all that in one? You know what I mean? Yeah. That's a Rover. Rover is that status joint. Like, yeah, son is, yeah, he's on it, you know? Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I really thank you, appreciate
man. It's
it.
Been an absolute pleasure rocking with y'all, man. I am floored and enamored and blown to pieces, blown away by this site, man. I can't speak enough on it, you know?
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we'll see you at your verified account.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Word up.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. Join us next week when we talk to the legendary Abi Odun Oyewole of The Last Poets. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. To make sure you never miss an episode of the show, please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can reach me with your thoughts about Outside the Lines via Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean. That's S-H-A-W-N. This podcast was recorded by Dan Berger. It was engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful Three Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Our show's intern is Sonny Kahara. Intro and outro music by Psionic. Interlude music by Sir Loin. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. And I'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.